Today's episode of the Film Stage Show is brought to you by Mubi, the online streaming cinema. For your free 30-day trial, go to mubi.com/filmstage. Back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the movie review podcast for thefilmstage.com. As always, I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan, and with me today to talk about Paul Thomas Anderson's Phantom Thread, we have Michael Snydell.
Hello!
Bill Graham.
Woo!
And a special guest today, we have Vikram Murthy.
How's it going?
It's good. How are you?
I'm doing all right.
Excellent. Well, thank you for joining us. Why don't you tell the fine people at home a little bit about yourself?
No problem. I'm a freelance writer and critic. My work is at places like the AV Club, Vulture, RogerEbert.com. I have written for other places in the past that it's easiest to find me on Twitter at FauxBeatPoet, FauxBeatPoet. And yeah, that's about it. I should have a website of some sort to collect all this, but I don't.
You got to get that, man. Got to get on that. Well, I was going to say the name of a website provider, but they don't advertise on here, so I'm not going to do it for free for them. Anyway, we are all here today to talk about Phantom Thread, the newest film from Paul Thomas Anderson, who's previously done a lot. Punch Drunk Love, The Master, that one that I didn't like. Inherent Vice.
Oh, no, Brian. Bad start.
yeah, I know. Controversial opinion. Was not a fan of Inherent Vice. That is one of those ones that every now and then I do say, you know what, I should watch again, try to give another chance. So maybe I'll do that. Maybe at some point that'll happen. Anyway, before we get into that usual stuff, find us on Twitter at Film Stage Show, Facebook, search for The Film Stage Show, email us, podcast@thefilmstage.com, find us on iTunes, give us a comment and rating, and patreon.com/thefilmstageshow, give a little bit, about $1 an episode, and you get access to our Slack channel, cool raffles, and you help us to produce more cool, awesome, sweet content. This month, because of our Patreon members, we will be reviewing Paris, Texas as our classical review. So, if you want to become part of that, help us out. Go to patreon.com/thefilmstageshow. And don't neglect to get your 30-day free trial subscription to Mubi by going to mubi.com/filmstage. Mubi has released into theaters Lover for a Day, and you can go on Mubi and see where that is playing as it goes wide. For anyone who doesn't know already, which seems frankly impossible, Mubi releases one new film each day on their platform, and you have 30 days to watch. So you have a 30 film rotating selection for you to check out. You can download them to your mobile devices. You can watch them on the go. You can use your smart TV. Because of Mubi's limited selection, they actually have one of the best apps for any video streaming service. Guys, like Hulu, Amazon, Netflix, every time I turn them on, I swear to God, I just get more angry at them. I can't even find the things that I've bought on Amazon most times, to the point where like I just have like $20 worth of media on there that I'm probably never gonna see. But Mubi doesn't have that problem. They've got a beautiful clean interface, and you should check it out. Go to mubi.com/filmstage and get a free 30-day trial on us, so that you can understand the wonder that is Mubi. Any other things before we get into our review, gentlemen?
I don't think so. I did see, though, I think something that is coming soon to Mubi is The Man Who Fell to Earth, which I want to give a big recommendation to. I think it's Bowie's only lead role, other than, I don't know, The Hunger, maybe? I don't know.
Wasn't he in Mr. Lawrence, Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, or...
Ah, fuck, you're right. All right, anyway, it's a good movie. It's coming to
Starting
movie.
Starting off strong.
That's all right. That's what I'm here for. I'm the ombudsman for the podcast to make sure that we don't say anything factually inaccurate. And on that note, this time, I just want to give myself big props for continuously saying Phantom Thread and not the Phantom Thread. For anyone who listens to this, you know.
Said that like two times by this point.
I know. And each time I did it correctly. And
oh boy.
Hopefully.
Oh man.
Hopefully that's going to keep up. Phantom Thread.
That's a Trumpian level of like just self-congratulation right there.
But like it's like if you have been on heroin every day for the past 15 years and then you finally go one day without it. Like that is a positive step in the right direction in breaking a very bad habit. So
you are soon to receive your five time badge, sir.
Yeah. I'm going to get my chip and it's going to be great. And then it'll screw up the next time that there's a film that I either add or subtract the definite article from when it's not there. Anyway, speaking of, let's talk about Phantom Thread, newest film written and directed by Paul Thomas Anderson. This movie stars Daniel Day-Lewis, Leslie Manville, and Vicky Cripes?
Cripes. Crepes.
Crepes?
Yep.
Like the flat French pancake?
I believe so.
All right.
I thought it was Cripes, but okay.
I've been saying Creeps all day, so oops on me for fucking that up.
No, not Creepy.
All right,
not
anyway. Creepy. Here is the trailer.
You can sew almost anything into the canvas of a coat. When I was a boy, I started to hide things in the linings of the garments. Things that only I knew were there. Secrets.
Good morning.
Will you have dinner with me?
All right, that is the trailer, part of the trailer for Phantom Thread. And how best to describe this movie? According to IMDb, set in 1950s London, Reynolds Woodcock is a renowned dressmaker whose fastidious life is disrupted by a young, strong-willed woman, Alma, who becomes his muse and lover. Can't do much better than that, so we'll stick with that for now. Let's let our guest, Vikram, start us off. What are your general capsule review thoughts on Phantom Thread?
I like it quite a bit. I saw it at a press screening, and then I caught it on 70mm at the Music Box. And it is very clearly one of those films where it will open up repeatedly and continually on every new viewing. It's a very dense film, which is what I like. And it's also, it kind of projects a lot of interesting ideas about control and romance and mutual affection that I think are very interesting. And most Paul Thomas Anderson movies, at least most Paul Thomas Anderson movies of this century, has a very interesting look to it that I think will work wonders on future viewings and how it's received in the future. That wasn't a great explanation or a capsule review, but that's what I'm going to go with for right now.
That was a fine, that just to put your mind at ease. I don't know if you've podcasted before, but that was perfect. And now let's see if my co-hosts can keep in the spirit of that, or if they will ramble for 10 minutes like usual. Michael Snydell.
I really, really like Phantom Thread. I did do the review for the site for the film stage. I guess what I really like about this film is PTA is someone I've liked for a long time, but I think, as Vikram was saying a little bit, I think that this century of Paul Thomas Anderson, I guess, which is starting with The Master and then Inherent Vice and now this one, is a kind of a different filmmaker than where he started. And I think Phantom Thread is an evolution that I'm really excited to see where he goes as a filmmaker in the next coming decades. I think this is really interesting in the ways that this seems to be very familiar with audience expectations about where this could go as a thriller, where it could go as a romance, where it could go as even, you know, a biopic of an imaginary person. But I think that it continually pulls away in smart, interesting and really involving ways. And I think not only is it a very dense experience that's continually kind of unspooling its layers, but I think it's also very entertaining. It's a really kind of like acridly funny movie with a lot of withering dialogue, and these performers just are in kind of perfect concert with each other throughout the movie. And I think the last thing I want to say about once a movie that is easy to watch, but only afterwards you realize how strange it was.
All right. Bill Graham, what about yourself?
I think it's interesting that Mike said that only after do you realize how strange it was, because I think for most of my audience, they realize how strange it was about, I'd say 2 hours in, into this 2 hour and 10 minute movie.
Isn't that pretty much the whole movie?
Well, that's when everything, all the shit hits the fan, really. This film is really interesting because it has a dynamic to it that feels, like Mike was saying, that feels kind of rudimentary, feels kind of knowing of its own genre and kind of the trappings of it, and then increasingly just kind of turns and turns and turns away from it. I thought I knew where this film was going. I haven't read that much about it. I hadn't heard that much about it. I just knew it was PTA. It was apparently Daniel Day-Lewis's last performance. And I was like, I'm in. Like, why not? And so when I went into the film, I, like most of PTA's films, I wasn't quite sure what to expect going in and how I would react to it afterwards. I walked out in just kind of a gleeful mood because this film is entirely too weird for most audiences, especially by the end. And yet I was entertained and just transfixed by some of the dialogue scenes in this film. Day-Lewis is just absolutely fantastic, but he is outshone by his two female co-stars in this by leagues, I think. And it's interesting that that dynamic plays out in so many different ways. It's beautiful. I love the way it sounds. I love the setting of it. And yeah, I enjoyed it from beginning to end. I have some quibbles here and there. I have some tidbits that, you know, I want to kind of explore with y'all. But for the most part, this is definitely a film that at the very, very least will either leave you confused, but also something to talk about. So, you know, I think anytime a film that gives you something to talk about after watching it is something that has done a good enough job to at least be worth a viewing.
Yeah, I didn't like this film that much. I would say that my predominant emotions during it were boredom and disinterest, but with a healthy dose of admiration, if that makes any sense. I think that there's definitely a lot of craft in this film, both in terms of the acting and the just straight objective filmmaking of it, but it doesn't cohere for me in a way that really puts it up into top tier cinema, let alone the top tier of what Paul Thomas Anderson is capable of. I feel like a lot of the themes and ideas expressed are rather half-baked and not very well integrated with one another. It takes a turn at a certain point that I feel like could have been seeded better. And in general, I just felt as though I was on the outside and that the film has a number of interesting avenues it can take, but kind of blithely skims across the surface like a stone thrown over a lake. And it doesn't ever dive deep enough to really draw my interest in. You have the world of like high couture fashion dressmaking that is just like rife for all kinds of allegory and even just like rote, how does this get made interest? And that never really takes off. I think that there's a lot of character work that could be done. Just like, I wanted to know more about the characters, but the movie seemed kind of blithely disinterested in them in some ways. And then towards the end, which I can't really talk about right now because we're not in spoilers, I wanted more of that. I wanted like a greater insight into that. I feel like this movie kind of skims from Kubrick to Hanukkah, and I wanted
one of those to win out, to take the best from either of them,
and not just kind of rock it on this surface level of both. It felt really kind of toothless in a way, how much it flirted with the trappings of those two filmmakers, but never really set down to the dirty business of doing what they did best to make this something more than just kind of an attractive bore. Which I'm judging from Michael's cackling is going to be a controversial opinion.
It's just Brian. It's too perfect.
Is it on brand, Michael? Are we going to call me on brand right now?
It's on brand, but it can't ever be as bad as Call Me By Your Name. So it's fine.
I mean, well, we don't know how old, you know, Alma is. So,
don't even, Brian. Don't even.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm looking. The thing is, you know, most times when I hate, I didn't hate this film. I just didn't like it that much. But most times when I don't like a film, especially one like this, where I'm kind of sitting in the theater and I'm just not clicking with it, I feel a kind of dread about being on this podcast and having to talk with you people about it. But for this one, I want to hear the things that worked for you all. I want to know if this is one of those situations where, like, maybe if I hadn't seen it alone at 10 p.m. on a Saturday night and then immediately come home and gone to bed, like if I had seen it with a friend. Which is, this makes my life sound very depressing. If I had seen it with a friend and like gone out for a drink afterwards, like I wonder if that would have deepened my appreciation. So I'm not going to be fighting you all. Quite the opposite. I want you all to like educate me in this and help me maybe like get some perspective that maybe will elevate it in my mind.
Brian's turned a new leaf.
Yeah, this is weird.
Well, like, it's a thing where it's like, I'm not sitting here being like, this movie is bullshit and it sucks and I don't understand why people like it. I kept seeing all the things that would usually make me like a movie. I mean, I'm not throwing out Kubrick and Hanukkah as insults. Like, those are two filmmakers that I love.
Absolutely.
And we were talking about, on the Call Me By Your Name episode, immoral behavior. And what makes someone in a film interesting when they do that, and what makes them like repellent. And this has some of that. And like in a Hanukkah film, I'd be all over it, just wallowing in the filth. But in this one, I was like, all right, well, that's happening now, I guess. I don't understand what the fuck is going on. Like, this isn't working for me in the way that I want it to. So, yeah, I want to know what's up.
Sure.
I want to hear what you all think. So what can we... What can we talk about in non-spoilers? Because, like, honestly,
sure.
In my head, this movie doesn't get interesting until the spoilery stuff happens. So,
I think one thing that's interesting about any film that revolves around a dressmaker who happens to be a male, I think that dynamic is really interesting because they never really effeminate Daniel Day-Lewis in this film. He's always impeccably dressed, but even so much as at one point hilariously having a vest and like a suit jacket over top of pajamas, and where like my audience just cackled during that moment. And it was just so absurd to see that kind of dichotomy of just like, okay, I guess he's just.
He like went and took a bath and then came down more dressed than when he had went up.
He was pulling it off, let's be honest.
I will say this for this movie.
Arguably.
This is a hilarious movie.
Yes.
It's very funny.
Yeah.
Yes.
There was a man in my audience who was just like having the best time. He did a literal fist bump at some point. And I was just, I wanted to like go and sit by him and be like, hey man, what's up? Like, how's it going? I would love to talk with you about this movie because you are giving me life right now. Yeah, so stuff like that was great. Vikram, well, I'm curious, you were quick to jump in and say that. Was there any, I'd love you to go into that in more detail.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, what I would say is that I think I was kind of mulling over what you were talking, your criticisms of this. And I find it interesting because I think that Phantom Thread in many ways buries the lead about what it's trying to do. Like, it's not a fashion movie. I think someone on Twitter made a very good point that it's more of a breakfast movie than a than a fashion movie. It's not really about fashion. It's not really about 50s London. It's not even really about love. Like, it's much more about how control gets either disrupted or mediated by another presence, and how that can sort of lead to both frustration, misunderstanding, tragedy, pain. And I kind of responded to that very well, because I you know, in many ways, Dan Day-Lewis could have any profession. Like, his character could do anything, really. He could be like an architect, and it would, like, the film would work in many of the same ways. It just, costume, like, fashion and costumes just work great on film generally. So it's a nice, like, it works well with the movie, but it's just like, he is a very particular sort of controlled guy. And when you introduce a new force in that sort of world, things inevitably get disrupted. But the difference is that this new force kind of fights back. And you can tell that sort of the big shift in this guy's life, the character's life, Reynolds Woodcock, because you see in the beginning, he has this old girlfriend, and it's very clear. He's like, she needs to get the fuck out of the house. Like, go. This is, it's too much. Like, I don't love her anymore. And she's just waiting around. I think Cyril says she's waiting around. She's getting fat, waiting around for you to fall in love with her again.
Yeah.
Which is hilarious. Yeah. But what I find interesting is that this is, it's very much about how, someone who wants every corner and every particular of their life to be exactly right, needs everything to fall apart for him to let go of that desire, which I think I respond to that very well. But I sort of understand what you're talking about, Brian, because I think a lot of people, I took my parents to see this, and they kind of were on the same way. They were on its wavelength eventually, but I think that they were expecting something a little less elusive. You're right. I mean, he kind of, Paul Thomas Anderson shortcuts a lot of things that I think people would expect or appreciate from this movie, such as like character work and all that. But I think it's much more, he's trying to capture these things in like snapshots in a way that I find really instructive and nice.
To piggyback on Vikram's thought a little bit too, Brian, one word that I really focused on was when you used the word skim, because I think I'd potentially use the word skim as well, but actually in a positive way, in the sense that a little bit similar to what Vikram is talking about, in the sense of I actually really like shortcuts, so I'm going to steal that word. It's the shortcuts that he takes in this story. And like, Brian, you spoke about how you don't really get to see, like, there's about two scenes of dressmaking. Yeah. And even those scenes about dressmaking are less about the dressmaking than, like, if you look at the camera movements, they're constantly about the connection between Alma and Reynolds, more so than anything about the actual craft of dressmaking. And so that's what I think is interesting about this idea of skim, because I view that in relation to expectations again, and to what we expect in this relationship and what we expect to see of this, you know, potentially, or of a fashion designer who's, you know, maybe a genius to the outside world, but in the inside world also seems to be living a very particular life, but also one that seems very unsatisfying to everyone around them. So I think that that's what makes this elusive, but not cold to me. Like, that's what I think I find so interesting about this film is that it, like, it was interesting that you were mentioning Kubrick, because I don't think this has the remove of Kubrick. Like, instead I was thinking of something like Max Ophuls or Max Ophuls in the sense of intimacy coming from intimacy from like magnifying this like body language and their communication with each other, and then realizing that by zooming in and seeing how their life interacts with each other, that it is at once like kind of supposed to be shallow, but also so supposed to be so strong and like overwhelming, that this relationship is built on like faulty foundations and not a lot of character work and like not a lot of traditional like desires other than a power structure that's constantly shifting. Like, I think that's what's kind of weird about it, is like the movie is kind of continually bearing how little of like traditional chemistry is there.
Which is, I mean, that's an interesting idea, but I just feel like I didn't get enough time with the two of them. I never felt like the movie was really like investing in showing me that to the extent that I would want it to. There's a lightness of touch to what this movie is willing to go into, in terms of the basically everything, but primarily the business of making these clothes, the process of designing and then implementing them, and then also all of the personal relationships that are there. And it was so glancing at each of those that I never felt like I had the time for any one of them in particular to really peer at it and study it. And that's kind of where my remove comes from. Like, my uncertainty is to, for the bulk of the running time, like what this movie found most interesting. The people on Twitter, who are the dumbest people on earth, have taken a lot of time to say that like this is another movie about like a male genius who you have to put up with, blah blah blah. But what's funny is that like in a given episode of Mad Men, which is not a perfect analogy, but in terms of time period and handsomeness of the male protagonist, pretty good. I mean, in a given episode of Mad Men, like the act of creating an ad consumes Don Draper to the point that like he can't hear anything else, he can't see anything else, and that's all he's focusing on. But like, all we ever really see Reynolds Woodcock doing is like sketching with his fountain pen in his pretty portfolio, and it's just it never really felt like he liked doing it or really wanted to, but like he sort of fell into it and was good at it, and he just likes attention. And
see, that's exactly how I would describe Don Draper. Like, yeah, I don't know. It's funny you're saying all this, because I definitely think that maybe this came through better on a second viewing, but I definitely think that he used, like, he kind of compressed a lot of information. I'm sorry, PTA compressed a lot of information into certain scenes. Like, I can sort of see how he shortcuts a little bit in terms of like the falling in love and sort of the traditional relationship arc thing. But I also think that like there's a very clear seduction scene in The Breakfast Order. There's sort of, she's sort of feeling him out in the staring contest scene when they're back at his house. Like, they may be compressed, but I definitely think he puts the time into like letting you sort of linger and marinate in the relationship. And maybe we have to take on spec that he's interested in like fashion or his job, but I definitely think from his like morning routine that he's someone who's interested in like details and someone who's interested mm-hmm. in sort of composure and it is sort of in aesthetics. And I definitely think that, like, when he's creating the dress for the woman from In the Loop, I forget her name. She's like the first person who comes in to get the dress. Like, you can
tell. Yeah, she's like a, I don't remember
her. Countess.
Yeah. Princess?
Princess, yeah. Or countess, or an heiress. Or
she's Countess Henrietta Harding.
Yeah. Or is that the other one?
No, the Countess is the first dress.
Right.
Then you have BB Blazer from fucking Frasier showing up to be the woman who's getting married.
That seems.
And then,
by the way, could I just say, like, that when they take the dress back, that is just
I don't think that doesn't, to me, count as a spoiler.
That is a spoiler? I don't know if that's a spoiler.
No, I don't. I definitely don't think so. I would say that the spoiler is, well, I can't say it obviously, yes. But I have a very hard line concept of what constitutes a spoiler, and I'll let you know if we get close to it.
I think there's even some.
But what's funny about that is I really thought that, like, and maybe, you know, I'm trying not to put my pedestrian film narrative desires on this movie, but it feels like it makes so many feints towards telling the kind of narrative that would have engrossed me, that whenever it did that and then pulled back, I was sort of not let down. Maybe let down. I don't know. I can't think. Just disillusioned, because I was like, oh, okay, they're stealing the dress back. This is going to be the moment where, like, he starts to, like, really buckle down and, like, want to make a lasting legacy that won't turn to ash like his mother's wedding dress or something.
Oh, man.
And, you know, it just, and that kind of comes into play, but at the same time, nothing ever really became the driving force of this movie. So I felt like I was being swept along, but more like by a strong wind on an open plain than by a fast current in a mountain river, if that makes any kind of sense.
Wow.
I'm an analogy guy. I don't know what to do.
Yeah, health analogy.
I think there's something to be said too. This might be a good place to talk a little bit about, I mean, PTA's filmmaking approach here too, because it is in its own way more plain than what you would, I hesitate to use the word plain because that makes it sound dull, because I don't think it's at all dull, but I think there is something a lot more restrained. I think there is a lot something that is more efficient and economical than what some people may have. You know, even compared to something like The Master, this has far less, you know, pyrokinetics in its composition choices or its camera work. Like, it is a much more, it is a film that doesn't necessarily have that, like, that, I don't know, I hesitate to say this again, but, like, an auteur pull that I think some of, especially earlier PTA hat. Like, I can understand where you're coming from there, Brian, but I think you're also as much reacting to, I mean, going from the fact that you didn't like Inherent Vice, I do think this has a lot in common in terms of rhythms and in terms of, in terms of the way that this moves and the way that the plot is less dictated by narrative than, you know, by gesture or something along those lines. So I, in a way, it's understandable that you didn't like Inherent Vice and didn't like this. Like, I think this is a very, this is definitely a continuation of that. And now I'm rambling a little bit, but if anybody else, like, has any thoughts about the filmmaking choices in this.
I'm not a big fan of Inherent Vice either. I've seen the film. I've tried to watch it twice. I think I stopped halfway through my second watch. But this film just worked on me because I found the whole setting and the whole relationship much more interesting, because it focuses basically on three people, and Inherent Vice had a lot of moving parts, and this film has one central focus and how he reacts and how he kind of bounces between those two poles. And I found that exploration much more satisfying over the course of a 2-hour, 10-minute film than anything in Inherent Vice, which was kind of made up of a lot of hijinks and things like that. I think the thing that really works for me is just the depiction of a self, I guess, infantile man that is also a somewhat of a creative genius, and in that at the very least he's established as someone that people seek out and that people on the streets of London or wherever he's at. I think it's London, right? I'm not mistaken there. Where is he?
I believe so.
It's in London.
Yeah.
That people basically on the streets A would even recognize his face, which is a little confusing for me because I might be able to pick Ralph Lauren out of a lineup of people, but if you gave me similar styled people, you know, gray, slick back, wavy hair, I would probably fail to choose him 9 times out of 10.
Or Daniel Day Lewis.
The fact that he is so like easy to recognize, I guess, in his day-to-day life as a dressmaker just kind of blows my mind. So that kind of sets the tone for like how big he probably is, right? Not just that, you know, heiresses and things like that come to him, but it's also like, no, the average person absolutely recognizes him and recognizes the name. And so I think all of that establishment is very, very interesting. And I find that kind of that exploration when he goes off to find his next muse, in a lot of ways, I find her being pulled into that world incredibly interesting. And I think that is the point where I really kind of gave into the film. And I think, you know, maybe I'm pushing too far, but I think that's where a lot of people probably find their way in and without a way out, right? Like, right. It's like once that point hits, it's like, okay, I'm in this for the long haul. I got to see what happens here.
But I guess my issue there is that like the life that he's living isn't particularly lavish.
No.
And so her getting pulled in, it didn't seem like that big of an adjustment for her.
Well, certainly she doesn't have to work the day-to-day life.
Well, yes.
That's one interesting aspect. But the other interesting aspect is that I feel like her day-to-day life was so uniform and so that he could give her a complicated breakfast order and take away her notes and she would immediately remember it. That's how rigorous and that's how kind of by the numbers her day-to-day has been, that he would basically come in, order this really weird, you know, breakfast item that's just full of fucking food. And in like small little details as well, and then be able to regurgitate it to him. Like he's such a disruption that she would just key in on exactly what he wanted. And so I think her day to day is entirely unknown. She doesn't know, like she mentions, she doesn't know when she's going to wake up in the morning. She asked him after the first night, kind of like, when am I going to wake up? And he's like, I'll just let you know. It's just like, what the fuck am I doing here? You know? And I think it's interesting because that through line follows her throughout this entire film where she's just constantly like, why the fuck am I here? I don't understand, you know?
And I think it's interesting that you bring this up because I think what she gets out of it is that she likes that this is someone who's like paying attention to her. It's not necessarily the lifestyle, but it's more that she's like the locus of attention in many ways for him. But as over the course of the film, and without getting into any spoilers, that also has a price. And while I think girlfriend's past would just leave, she doesn't. And the fact that she doesn't leave and the fact that she kind of pushes back is what sort of makes the relationship interesting. But I'm curious because Brian, did you like The Master?
Oh, I loved The Master, yeah.
So, okay. That's very interesting. I find The Master much more enigmatic, elusive, not working on typical narrative footing, not moving through sort of kind of moving through a very sort of snapshot like feeling and emotion and keeping everything close to the chest. Whereas this, I mean, I understand that it doesn't, it sort of zigs where it's supposed to sag, and it may not give everything that it attempts to give, or may not give everything that it is sort of expected of it to give you. But I also think that it's very much like, in many ways, it's very much a traditional seduction love story that gets twisted by, what's the word? By a certain level of
change.
or just a certain level of frustration that I think
It's interesting that you say that, because it's true. And in a way, the story of The Master is a very similar story to this one, where it's like a fastidious man who's got an empire, and he finds this person and then just kind of takes them in, to the lack of understanding of all the more serious people in his life. But like, The Master, like, truly was a, they're both about that relationship, but I feel like The Master just like took more time with it and really like pressed it. And I could kind of chart the reasons why Freddy and The Master was doing everything for Philip Seymour Hoffman's character. And I guess, so this is a decent analog. So in The Master, there's that scene where they're doing the kind of, I don't know what they call it. Basically, it's auditing, you know, and he has to keep his eyes open and answer all the questions.
Sure.
And the closest thing in this movie to that is the dinner of asparagus.
Yes.
And it just felt like, it felt like this, I'm sure this isn't true, but it felt like Paul Thomas Anderson was having a real hard time writing out like a compelling and meaningful dialogue exchange during that scene. So he wrote in like placeholder dialogue that he'd go back and clean up and like really work on later, but then just didn't have time to. Like, that whole scene was such a frustration for me in this film, because I was waiting for them to like really, again, crack the surface. And like, I have had similar fights in my life that I felt exposed a little more psychological depth and interest than that scene did. And I was like, I was excited and kind of on the edge of my seat for that scene, because it really did feel like it was going to be the dam burst moment. But instead, it wasn't. And it ended without anything really being resolved, or even having been said, that like I couldn't have already picked up from the action. And I didn't feel as though I gained any new information related to either of those characters. And I didn't feel as though it had progressed their relationship along. And so I was just kind of, it was frustrating. I was frustrated. I can't think of a better word to describe my feelings at the end of that scene than, you came so close and now there's nothing. Like, at the end of that scene in The Master, you had Freddy kind of broken down. And it, despite like the utter animosity that had been dredged up by that, he suddenly becomes more indebted than ever to The Master. And in this movie, that scene happened, and then it kind of faded away in terms of like my consciousness of it during most of the rest of the movie.
But I understand where you're coming. I'm sorry, Vikram. I interrupted you.
You go.
I think I understand where you're coming from in terms of that analogy, but I'm getting stuck a little bit on pointing to that exact scene with Philip Seymour Hoffman and Joaquin Phoenix, because I think that the problem with comparing these two is that Philip Seymour Hoffman is someone who, while there's certainly a dubiousness to everything that he says, he's in a way constantly honest and like, you know, is is he's not oblique in his communications. Like, he talks about his feelings, and even though he's kind of peddling bullshit, like, that's a little bit different than someone like Woodcock or Alma, because I think those are both characters who don't really know how to communicate with each other. And that's what that dinner scene really got across to me, was just clearly how much this relationship is also based on these false promises and and this like fundamentally clashing rhythms in a way that The Master to me very much was about these two people, as you're saying, from like very opposite walks of life who do fit together and nearly perfectly, even though it's, you know, it's this own psychological thing.
But yeah, like that relationship between Freddy and the Master, whose name I can't remember, so I'm just going to refer to him as though I'm in his cult, apparently. Their relationship is so adversarial that it somehow becomes constructive.
There's that great scene where they start fighting and then start hugging right in front of the house right after they go to jail, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's the thing that carves like the landscape. It's like the fire and ice that just create something greater. But I mean, I understand what you mean. Like, this movie is all about these two people who aren't really good at communicating. And maybe it's because like Woodcock doesn't have the patience and she just doesn't have the words. But like I said, I just kind of, I'd already gotten that. Like, I'd already figured that out. And so that particular moment just didn't, it was interesting. It was well acted. I liked it. I think that it's interesting that he made an argument that is an argument that I've had every now and then, where it's like, look, you know how I like my thing made, or like, you know that I don't enjoy going ice skating. Why the hell would you bring me here? Like, what are you attempting to do? Why are you making things more difficult when I'm so very clearly not the type of person who wants to do this? And, but I kind of look for a movie to either be like a reflection of my own experience or like introduce me to a new experience, or do something more than like give me less than what I could get if I just got the wrong order at a restaurant. And I just feel like this movie never took that final deep breathed plunge to become a little bit more than I'd already experienced that it might be able to tell me something about my own life or what people are going through in general.
I think if that sequence in particular doesn't work for you, I don't think this entire film is going to work for you. And I hate to put that blunt of a statement on it, but I truly think that if you're not connecting to it and that sequence doesn't work for you, then the rest of the film is going to fall flat. Because if you're already kind of coming at it from the stance that that scene didn't explore anything that the other scenes hadn't already done, I feel like that sequence does a great job at actually having them attempt that, because to this point they haven't attempted it. And at this moment they vocally.
Like, it was like non-verbally yes. for that. Sorry, Bill. Go ahead.
Yes. And so by this moment, everything shatters and everything is pulled away and there is nobody else in the room to kind of make little quibbles or kind of make little comments and things like that, or, you know, to be shown up in front of. And so they can literally shout at each other. And we haven't seen Woodcock to this point really raise his voice. We haven't seen Alma to this point really be as emotional as she is. And so I think, yes, they don't say anything necessarily new, but it's all been bubbling underneath the surface. And it's at this moment that they actually have the time and the opportunity to just go full force at each other. And do they, you know, kind of miss each other by a few feet? Sure, maybe. But I think that's all part of their struggle of like figuring out how to communicate with the other person. Because the other thing is, during that sequence, they very noticeably like talk and shout over each other at various points. So they're clearly not listening to each other. They're just stuck kind of in their ways. And so I feel like that sequence kind of explores that in a way that I wasn't expecting, and in a way that like, I just found the dialogue fascinating. And I knew from that point on, any kind of interaction between them, any kind of argument would be even more interesting, because it could bubble over one way or another. And I found, like, that was the big turning point for their relationship, because I think he had never been treated like that by any of his previous muses, except for Cyril. And Cyril obviously is his sister, and so
she's not having it.
Yeah, well, and I think he responds to that. That's why she's around, right? Because not only does she kind of keep his shit in order, but she also rebuffs him at various points and that was
one of the fist pump moments for the guy down the aisle from me. Was when she says, like, "You won't end me, I'll end you, I'll cut right through you."
Yes.
And he was acting like it was a Marvel film and the fucking Hulk had just beat someone to death. Like, he was so happy.
God. That sequence, and because we have never seen anybody fight back against Woodcock at that moment. And so when she does it, it seems like it's a relish for us as an audience, because we've never seen that sequence happen. But B, it feels so old hat that she, all the things that she does, and then she immediately announces that and then sips on her little cup of coffee or tea or whatever it is. And it's just like, it's just so like, no, I'm not dealing with you. And I've done this, you know, 1,000 times with you, you know, I will win in this situation, you know? And so I just love how much that kind of tells us as far as history within just a short little sequence. Like, fuck off, dude, you shut up. Don't argue with me. You know, it's just like, holy shit, they've had this argument before.
I think it's important to realize that, especially that dinner sequence between Alma and Reynolds, that Alma's experience with Reynolds has been entirely mediated by other people. It's been mediated by Cyril. It's been mediated by the job, by, you know, the auction houses, by everything. It's just like their life is not their own. It's shared by the house. And I think that when you strip everything away, it becomes this sort of war zone in which Alma tries to be a part of someone's life and the life that she's trying to be a part of has no business being on its own. You know, like, it's like Reynolds doesn't know how to live on his own. He knows how to live in a house where everything is sort of working together to fulfill his desires. And her whole thing is, I want to make asparagus the way I like it, and I don't give a damn what you think about it, even though I'm trying to do it for you. That's sort of the interesting conundrum, which is that she's like, I want to make this dinner for you, but I'm also going to do it my way, in which that may not work with your desires. And I think that's sort of the interesting... I agree with Bill that if that scene doesn't work for you, that sort of throws the rest off, because after that scene, it's what gives her the motivation to do the thing. But I also think that there's something to be said about the fact that there's something to be said about control. I keep going back to control, but I also think it's very important, which is that if there's any sort of extended metaphor for what Reynolds' job is, it's that he can do what he can do entirely through his own design, but he cannot do it on his own. So he relies on the dressmakers. He relies on Cyril to fulfill his vision, but he also doesn't seem to understand that his vision is sort of old hat. Like, it's everything sort of crumbling, even though everything is very put together. And then when Alma comes into the picture, he just assumes she's going to fit neatly into the structure of the house that he's built, and she has no interest in doing that. And that dinner is the first time where she's like, no, I want my relationship with him to be like its own thing. I don't want it to be something that he, you know, sort of like allows it to happen. I want it to be my thing. And then when it doesn't work out, he, you know, there has to be something that lays him low, you know?
Sure. And
I love when he talks about his own gallantry at just even trying to eat.
Yes.
It's also the funniest. That's the funniest line of that movie. Is just like,
yes,
like I'm admiring my own like gallantry at not complaining or whatever.
According to the man who was sitting down the aisle from me, the funniest line in the movie was when he railed against the word chic.
Oh, yeah. Well,
just for an example, like, look how much pepper he adds to that, like, five pieces. It was it salt? I thought it was pepper.
Yeah,
I
can't remember. It was so
it was like five or six pieces of asparagus spears, and it's just like he took handfuls and was just like, I am salt baying the shit out of this thing. And it was just like, oh my god, what is he doing?
It just kept happening. It was amazing. I suppose that we're at the point now where we should get into the spoiler section, since we've pretty much plot-wise walked up to that line. I will say that, like, just to like close out my own muddled thoughts here, everything that you guys are saying is something that, like, I assumed or thought. And I do think it just comes down to that weird X factor that sometimes happens in movies, where, like, that, sure, that catalyst for the deeper reaction just somehow isn't there for me. It's just not working in the way that it usually would. And like everything that you all are saying, I definitely agree with and have kind of circled around on an intellectual level, but that extra something just isn't there for me. I mean, like, and here's where I'm at.
They
I
would cooked probably it in too much oil. Like,
yeah. They used butter. I would have preferred they used oil. that'll work. That's a decent food metaphor. So, like, I would still say that I'd give this movie like a B-, which is not a bad grade at all. I just think I'm just disappointed in like how cold it left me.
Brian, I'd see it again.
I mean, I may. Yeah. I've got to see Inherent Vice again. I'll throw myself a weird Paul Thomas Anderson marathon.
I'd see this again before I'd see Inherent Vice again. And I love Inherent Vice to death, but I think that all of the sort of issues you have are understandable, but I think they clarify, a lot of things gets clarified on the second.
And honestly, you know, I think it may just be that, like, this is one of those movies where even while I was in the middle of watching it, I found myself thinking, I think if I knew where this was going, I'd be having more fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's well, very that, possible because the movie doesn't
that's
open
the
with
push.
Like, yeah, sorry,
that's the push pull of like any of these movies is, you know, especially when they're kind of, and I hate to pull it in, but, you know, awards consideration stuff and kind of things like that. And you kind of want to go in without really any expectation besides, ah, fuck, like this is going to be awards movie, so it should be good. Right. But, you know, it's one of those issues when you don't know where a narrative is going, and if you reject kind of where the narrative ultimately ends, it's hard to, without a second viewing, kind of reconcile that, right? It's like, okay.
Well, it's funny because I actually kind of loved where this ended up, and we'll get into that. But that's kind of what I was saying earlier. It was like, it goes somewhere I think would be more interesting if it were more the whole film. But when we get into spoilers, we'll talk about it. But yeah, I think definitely, like I said earlier with my wind versus river analogy, like, you know, I think knowing where this is going, I might be able to feel the motions a little more, because this isn't like a plot heavy movie. It doesn't have, it's not objective based, unless you count that wedding dress, but, you know.
Anyway, or there are objectives, but they don't necessarily matter.
Yeah, it's like it's the saving the rec center, but like if your characters went and fucked off and did something else while everyone else saved the rec center. So yeah, that's let's talk spoilers for Phantom Thread again, avoiding the definite article. So spoilers, if you haven't seen it, just get out of here, because we're going to start talking about spoilers. How many movies this year are going to involve poison mushrooms?
I think there were three.
I think there's three, right?
Yeah, go ahead. Name them.
I don't think it's a spoiler to just say that poison mushrooms are involved if we don't say how they're used. But this, the Beguiled, and Lady Macbeth?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It's the year of the poison mushroom.
Like last year's the deer, right?
The deer was still this year too.
Oh, that's right. Damn.
Deers have been getting killed for a couple years now. I was trying to explain it to my wife. I was like, it's one of those things that like you don't notice till you notice it, and then you just wonder if everyone was at the same cocktail party. And like heard like one person told like one person who's not even involved with any of them was like, I ate a bad mushroom, I got so sick, I thought I was gonna die. And all these different artists were like, poison mushrooms, eh? I should think about using that in my next film. And then they did, and they all just happened to come out at the same time.
I think it's interesting, just the mushroom as a whole, because there is kind of like a legendary kind of mystique to it, right? And I think part of the reason that these films may or may not be using it in this way is just simply because, for the most part, when you look at a mushroom, you can't tell the difference between what maybe is poisonous and what isn't unless they kind of go through. And, you know, there were more than likely a – because mushrooms are a delicacy in a lot of ways, you know, you have the – what are they? The truffles or whatever. And so because of that, I think there's a lot of herbiculture, I guess is what it's called, on like – telling the difference between them, because like berries and not that, you know, all that interesting visually, and also because you also usually have to make it with something sweet, so it's like, okay, you're feeding me a shit ton of desserts right now, what's going on, you know, versus, oh, you made me a wonderful breakfast omelet, thank you, you know. So I think there's something to just kind of having a book on like, here's how you tell this mushroom from that mushroom, and please do not ingest this mushroom. And I don't know. I think mushrooms are very kind of, they have kind of a mystique around them, because I know for certain, if someone was to hand me a wild mushroom that they just picked off the ground, I would bat it out of their hand. I'd be like, you're a fucking psychopath.
I am lucky because I hate all mushrooms. So no matter what, I am safe from someone trying to serve me a death cap. A death cap. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome. And,
death cap for cutie.
Yeah. You find a cute girl, you give her a poison mushroom, and then as she's dying, you say that.
They probably made a song about that actually.
That would be the worst way to die.
Have you ever seen the Irish horror film Shrooms?
No.
I would encourage everyone right now just to look it up, because it's got like one of the best horror posters like that I've ever seen. Is it
found footage, Bran?
No, it's not. It's the moon, it's rising, and like the whole poster is from ground level, and it's three mushrooms growing up and covering the moon in a way that it makes it look like a skull.
That's pretty good.
Oh yeah.
That's worth the price of admission right there.
I have seen that movie. I remember very little of it. And I can't say whether or not you should watch it. But that poster, I almost bought just because I liked it so much. So what happens in this movie is Alma poisons Reynolds with some bad mushrooms, as ladies in pretty dresses are wont to do. And he gets sick. She nurses him back to health. He asks her to marry him. She agrees. They get married. It is not great. And then at the end of the movie, she makes him an omelet with some more bad mushrooms, and he sort of like he like willingly eats it, because he knows that at the end of the torturous indigestion or gastrointestinal distress period, he will be back and they will be okay again, and then they can get back to the business of business. And
do you guys know what inspired this movie? I know it's been said a lot, but I just wondered if you guys had heard it.
Mushrooms? I don't know.
PTA was sick, and he was noticing how his wife, Maya Rudolph, had this like gleam as she was taking care of him. And he realized that, like, hey, that's a good thing to make a movie about. And he was also reading a biography about a fashion designer at that point, and so we combined those two interests.
I think the line he used was, she would much prefer me being sick than ever.
Yes.
Interesting. I mean, and that's kind of what I'm talking about. Like, that is like, when that became a thing that was happening, like when she just straight up told him to his face, like, I want you on your back, helpless, I want to nurse you back to health, and then you can be like back on your feet.
Kinky.
And he's like, and he just is like, all right, and then swallows it, and he's like, all right, let's rock this weird little dance of ours together. And then they're in the bathroom, and he's like, do you really love me? And she's like, of course. And he's like, then you're gonna want to leave because this is gonna get ugly. Like that is some hardcore like Michael Haneke piano teacher style like just craziness. And I loved it, and I just kind of wish that like that hadn't been the end. I wish that had been
the movie,
the whole movie. Yeah, like I wish, sure. That or at least like maybe like the second act turn. Like I just wish that there was like more of that where he.
You should see Al, Brian.
I mean, maybe yeah, I should. I missed that last year.
It's funny, but, you keep mentioning Haneke. Like I don't see Haneke in this at all.
No,
really.
Yeah,
like with the whole weird psychosexual let's hurt each other to love each other type of thing.
Well, okay, I mean, all right, but I definitely think that, like, okay, I mean, I like, but Haneke is just so like fucking it. There's such a cruel remove to it that this is like it's built on at least like passion here. Like it's built on like there's more like just sort of base level love, I think, here than in Haneke. Maybe that's my anti-Haneke bias talking, but
that's possible.
But I do I like enough Haneke, but I definitely don't like think that I think that Haneke has a certain vibe and a tone to it that isn't present here.
I don't know. I mean, we could argue about whether or not this gets close. I mean, but it was the visceral reaction I had. I was like, oh, it's like a Haneke film. And I was like, is it? And then I just decided to roll with it. And the more I think about it, the more, yeah, I think it really is, you know, as I said, I'm sure that there are other European directors who could kind of get the same thing. It's any of those. You can almost say like,
I'd say Hitchcock,
Yorgos
before
Lanthimos.
Yeah. Haneke. Yeah.
I don't know, but it definitely is like it's I wish that like I wish because I said that I kind of got their issues so early. I feel like the much more interesting move for this movie would be to like really drill down and hang out with them as they go through this weird cycle of her just poisoning him and then nursing him back to health.
Munchausen's,
like, both of the yeah, it's like a Munchausen's by proxy, but like he wants it.
Well, I think the
consensual.
Other interesting thing,
Florence Nightingale syndrome plus Munchausen's by proxy plus weird BDSM type of thing.
I think one of the interesting things about this film, kind of from where this film potentially leads for their relationship and things like that, is the fact that this film is bookended by her conversation with the doctor. Right. And so I have a feeling that she called him, told him what she was doing. He's intrigued. And she's basically like, let's make this something that I can do without like actually killing him. And then that's something that he's agreed to as well. And I think the implications there are basically like, let's maybe not make such a violent, torturous version of this, but like, let's tone it down a little, but also still knock him on his ass. Like, can we give him a low-grade fever all the time?
Guys, I'm slightly worried that we're making a little bit too much of this last scene. I mean, I think it's just as big. I mean, Brian, you already mentioned that there are two different poisonings, and after the first poisoning is where the marriage happens. But, like, the film's pacing and rhythm and the sense of time completely changes after that scene. Like, I think I mean, obviously that second poisoning scene, I mean, it's like a fantastically like a tense and more, you know, like present moment than I'd say a lot of the film. But like I'd say before that, around the time that they decide to get married, and that coming right after, like, and this is obviously up to interpretation, but you could honestly say that Reynolds' realization that he wants to marry Alma comes with a false sign that he almost thinks that his mother's ghost is working through Alma. Like, on the second time I watched this, like, I realized that you could almost interpret this as this idea as Reynolds believing that this curse that he believes he has, well, I should say simultaneous curse and believing that he's also his own kind of god, like, that there's, like, a level of illusion and, yeah, like, falseness to all of this even before they get married. Like, I think that it does make sense that we focus on that, or it does make sense that we at least talk about that second mushroom scene, but I think there's a lot to be said about that weird period from when they get married to the New Year's Eve experience to the party they go to where their age divide is finally briefly mentioned, where they're literally put at opposite sides of the table. Like, I think that there is just as much a kind of different mediation on control in those moments. I even love how, I guess the last scene we see of them working on a dress, Alma is essentially wearing the same apron as everyone else, but it's also slightly distinguished. I can't remember exactly how, whether it's a different color or something, but it's this idea that, like, where she was, you know, seen as kind of a grunt by Woodcock for so long. But now if she chooses to be a part of this and, you know, shares in being a part of the House of Woodcock, it becomes something else. And that's where I think that relationship with power becomes a lot more interesting and kind of a lot more complicated and unresolved. Like, even before we get into, like, the final BDSM thing.
I would say, just to piggyback on, because I agree with everything Michael just said, I will say that I'm hesitant to, like, overlay any sort of traditional standard arc over their relationship, because I think that's just boring or whatever. But I do think that there is their relationship is defined both by shifting power imbalances and by a constantly vacillating move between instability and stability. And where they get to normalcy, you don't understand what normalcy is until the second poisoning, but the first poisoning is this, like, he needs to lay himself low. And it's interesting that it's almost foreshadowed by the first, there's a scene earlier where he gets sick, but it's not like poisoning sick. It's just, he's just,
right. She sort of makes it seem like after, like, a big intense bout of work, he goes into, like, a depressive state, right, or like a sugar crash,
stress coma.
Yeah.
And
so I actually thought it was building up to a revelation that she'd been doing this to him for a while and that he was low key aware of it, because he is at every moment of her making that omelet, like, seems to be totally aware of what's happening.
Well, yeah, it's also, like, super sexually charged. I mean, like, it's very much what it becomes is that I think the first poisoning is him. I agree with Michael that it's sort of like he thinks that she's, like, channeling his dead mother. And then, you know, after they get married, things get back to quote unquote normal, which is just instability, power imbalance, fighting, all of that stuff, because she wants to live her life. He wants to live his life. And those are both at odds because of, you know, various things, age differences, just intention, whatever. But she's always going to be this thorn in his side. And the only way they get back to quote unquote normal with, and just emphasize the scare quotes around normal, is that she has to take care of him by poisoning him. And once he's on board with that, that becomes sort of the fulcrum in the relationship, which is that they can only ever share power when one of them is ill. Which I don't know, man. I think that's just great. I think that's the most fascinating, interesting take on a relationship in which one person is a quote unquote artist and the other person is a quote unquote muse, because the only way for the muse to ever have power is if the artist is literally vomiting in a toilet.
Yeah, it's, I mean, and like I said, that's a super interesting idea, and I think I'd be more interested to go back and see the film through the prism of understanding that that's where it's going.
Ryan, I put money on the fact if you see this again, you'd like it more. Because every
how much money?
I put about $20.
So you want to make it so like if I go back, see it, and like it more, I owe you $20. But if I come back, and
I don't know if I
still feel the same. You,
but a hypothetical $20, I would.
Okay, I have no time for hypothetical bets. I'm a man with a baby. I need money.
Need diaper money.
Touché.
Speaking of, the baby is still sleeping soundly, the monitor shows me, so we're doing great.
Oh, man.
What was I going to say? Yeah, I mean, speaking of baby, they end this movie, they have a baby.
Well, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. I think so as well. Yeah.
Wait, what do you mean, maybe?
The second time I thought that was something that happened, or excuse me, the first time I thought that was absolutely something that happened, and the second time I watched it, it's like narrated over her talking to the doctor, and I'm not sure if mm-hmm. that's like a idealistic flash forward.
Yeah, because I think
yes.
I don't know if the movie doesn't seem to operate in the way that would say it was an idealistic flash forward. I think it's an actual showing of their future over her idealistic monologue with the doctor.
I think it could be right.
She says, like, I can see our future, and like it's not syncing up perfectly, but I think it's showing an objective representation of what she is talking about and the ways in which it happens.
So do you have an optimistic view of where this relationship will end when the credits come?
Is it optimistic? I mean, there's still a guy getting poisoned every now and then.
No, I understand, but that flash forward is a version of this relationship that is closest to, you know, like normalcy. I think there are people, I think that some people would interpret that scene optimistically or pessimistically, depending on how they view that overall relationship to an extent.
I mean, I don't know. It's I hadn't thought to put the words optimistic or pessimistic on it. I think that that's just the way it is. And I think that given the way that they are, that's the best they can hope for. Whether you want to say that's optimistic or not, I would prefer to say that it's like pragmatic.
Okay.
But I mean, you know, they have a baby. Great. What's that goddamn child's life going to be like? And
yes, you know, that's my question.
Yeah, I mean, because like, here's the thing. In a normal movie, a person having a baby is like happily ever after. But now that I have a child, I'm more attuned to the fact that like that friggin' kid's got to grow up. You know, like it's not.
Yeah,
like,
the story doesn't end movie, there.
Yeah, if my life was a movie and it just ended with Cora getting born, like that is woefully inadequate, because now you've just introduced a whole other character, and if their life is shit, then my life being okay doesn't mean anything. That's a weird tangential rant, but like, yeah, I don't think you can look at them having a baby and sharing everything as being perfection and optimism. But I think that she appears to have found a way to assert her agency.
Sure.
And I think that in general, her influence is a positive one. It's gross positive. I don't know if it's net positive. if that makes any sense.
Sure.
You know, like when you add everything up, like the positive impact still may bring them out in the red, but you know, her saying that like she's gonna keep everything up because she's obviously younger than him but still has respect for what he does and is learning the trade, so it seems as though she's like becoming the caretaker of his memory and his work while at the same time doing her own.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I guess that's optimistic. But again, it's only optimistic if you think these two people should be together, which I don't know that they should be, but they are. And they seem to have found a mechanism that works for them. And, you know, that's more than a lot of couples can say.
Brian, so. I am thinking about it. The one reason why I do maybe think that it is real, as you're saying, is a narration, is we do get that great shot of Cyril as she's rolling the stroller back and forth. And it's like this this slow, like, expression that just becomes grim. She just realizes that, like, her brother, you know, has found someone and she's going to have to deal with this, you know, this third point of the triangle for the rest of her life. Like, there is something very, like, realistic and in the moment about that expression in a way that doesn't have, like, the rosy glow that you might attribute to some kind of, you know, idealistic flash forward.
And I think that one of the ways this movie still continues to intrigue me even past its the lack of impact it had when I was viewing it is when she is helping that woman at the end to look over her dress in that dressing room area they have. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think Reynolds is in that room with them. It is just Alma helping that woman with her dress. And so it becomes, he very clearly does not like to watch people living in his dresses. he goes to see the Countess Henrietta, whomever, and he watches her like walk down the stairs for her entry and then immediately pieces out, because it's like he has seen the part of the night that was important to him. And as we see later with Rebecca or Bonnie or whatever her name was, BB Blazer from Frasier.
Sure.
Sometimes watching someone walking around in your dress can be the worst thing ever, because you've done this thing to make them look beautiful and there they are acting like a monster. And so it's interesting because it seems to say that a lot of his dissatisfaction came from having to imagine people living their lives in his clothing. And now he has the ability to kind of shunt that part of the work off so that he can just continue to create these beautiful ideas, and then she can shield him from the ugly reality of what all that means.
I think that's a good point. I definitely think there's definitely something that she's giving him professionally that he can't get on his own, or at least through Cyril. But I do think that I find it interesting, Michael, you use the word optimistic and pessimistic with their relationship at the end, because I definitely think they're going to make it. Like, I don't know. Like, I definitely felt like they came to what I found very romantic about that ending was that it's very much like for the first time they're both on the same page. And it felt like, especially the first time I saw it, that when I think his line is like, kiss me before I get sick.
Yes.
That's just it felt like the whole thing snapped into place for me, where it was just
what a beautiful line. That was.
Oh my God. Like, are you kidding me? Like, get out of town. Like,
after he spends 20 minutes cutting and chewing that omelet and then swallows it, and he's like, kiss me, my darling, before I get sick. And I'm just like, yeah.
That whole scene and Greenwood's score in that moment. Oh my God. It's transcendent.
Was all of the music that played throughout Greenwood's score, like the piano and the,
I think almost,
or was any of that?
I think 98% of it is him.
Yeah.
Okay, because that's something we didn't talk about. This is a fucking beautiful score.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of people could even, let's assume that I hated the movie to the point that I couldn't even watch it. I could have closed my eyes and just let the score take me, and I would have been okay. Which is one of the reasons why I didn't say that I hated this film. I just found it less than I would have liked. But like that score, these performances, the camera movements, the cinematography, like there's just too much good work being done to dismiss it outright. I just wish that it had worked a little better for me.
Sure.
Yeah.
I feel like we have to at least mention that I guess Paul Thomas Anderson is like sort of credited as the cinematographer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to mention that.
Yeah, this thing looks I just think it looks incredible. Like what he's doing with how there, it's almost like soft lighting or something. It just, there's something, it feels very both warm and old. Almost like
a lot of the scenes, it felt almost like someone had just walked through smoking a pipe.
Exactly.
If that makes
sense. Yeah.
The temperature of the room at all given points. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. I also think there's a certain, it's not a, it's almost like, I'm trying to figure out the right word for it. It's not soft focus, but there's definitely something in which it's like 10% faded to the point where it's not like a faded photograph look, but it's very much like someone has put a nice light sheen on every image in it. And I don't know.
What... It's like it's been shot through a very delicate lace.
Exactly. and I wish I knew more of the technical vocabulary to help me out here, but I definitely think that it looks very different than when Elswit shoots for it. It definitely, he swears that he didn't shoot it. I don't know if I believe that, but because he's like, everyone else did it. I'm like, I don't know. Maybe. but I think he's doing something real, real interesting here.
The sound design in this music, the sound design in this movie is also great. I think I have a thing for movies that take place in old houses with very loud footsteps. Between this and Mother, it's just like, if I get a movie where I hear feet clomping down on a hardwood floor.
It's there and like, Call Me By Your Name as well.
Yeah, yeah. And very sonorous door closings.
Yeah, that film is certainly full of it. And then, Mother as well. Sorry, Michael, for bringing up that mental breakdown.
God. Not trying to trigger Michael.
Michael's wrong about Mother. I'll be fine.
I know. We all know this. It's confirmed. It's
Vikram, that was a private conversation. What I want to say briefly before we get away from the cinematography is like, Brian, your lace description was beautiful, but I think what makes this interesting is, you know, I think there's a lot of, I feel like the en vogue thing is, you know, doing kind of gauzy, you know, what we're talking about, soft focus, you know, a very diaphanous experience. But I think what makes Phantom Thread interesting is that there is still a solidity. That, like, I don't feel like everything, like, even as there is like a velvety feeling of watching this movie, it doesn't feel quite as dreamy
this in no way feels dreamy.
Yeah, which I think is such an interesting contradiction. Like that it can be so soft, but also kind of tempered with this harshness.
It's almost the opposite. It's almost like when you first wake up and your eyes haven't really adjusted. And maybe your like lashes are glued together a little bit, so like there's a veil over the world. I saw this movie in a 70mm projection at AFI Silver in Silver Spring, just outside the city, and
good
where I go for all my 70mm.
What was good that? Masking this time, no commuter problems.
Oh my god, yeah. Well, the commuter was at a shitty AMC theater in fucking Beltsville, but this one. This one, I go to the AFI Silver for every time that there's a movie that's showing there in 70mm. It's where I saw Dunkirk. It's where I saw The Master and
Lost City.
Oh, the other one, Inherent Vice.
Oh,
did you say Broad City?
No, I said Lost City of Z. Wasn't that?
Oh yeah, that's where I saw Lost City of Z. Yeah, it's one of the few places around here that like gives a fuck, and it's an old style movie palace. Like it's been rehabbed from I think the 30s, and it's great. And it's beautiful, and there's a lot of seats, and there's not a bad seat in the house. Go to AFISilver.com for movies and showtimes. Actually, it's AFI.com/silver. Anyway, so yeah, I went there, and I was just... It's kind of funny to me. This doesn't have to do with this movie specifically, but it does have to do with movie going. It's funny to me that like just going to a theater where you know they're not going to fuck up, and you know you're probably not going to get into a fist fight with someone... can like elevate the experience for you.
I wholeheartedly agree.
Yeah. Like I walked in there and I just like, I let out a breath. Cause I was like, there they are, the curtains and the masking and everything. And I know that the lights are going to go down at the right place. And behind me, they're going to spool some fucking film through a projector. And there's going to be someone back there who's been trained in this and will do it properly. And everyone who's here who paid to see this is probably not going to want to fight me when I wake them up after they've fallen asleep and started snoring. Like,
yeah,
I know that's a super low bar, but that's just where I'm at right now. I was really happy to go see this movie just from a tactile film going experience. And it lived up to that.
Brett, you've had the worst audience experiences of anyone I've ever talked to in my entire life.
And this is funny because this time it was the best because again, there's that man down the row
that
who just was like having the time of his goddamn life.
Honestly, that would be my experience a lot of the times if I didn't visit the theaters that I do, because there's definitely theaters that I've gone to, like some of the Studio Movie Grills and the AMCs and things like that, that I used to visit a little bit more frequently as part of press screenings and stuff like that, where they invite public to basically fill out the rest of the seats, which is always my nightmare. When I'm watching them come in and I'm like, do not sit near me. Oh my God, you already have your phone out. Like, you know, look at that giant bag of popcorn. You're going to eat all of it, aren't you?
Feet are on my head.
Yes. So I've definitely had some experiences in fucking press screenings where I turned at someone and told them to be quiet and they tried to rebuff me and I was like, fuck off. And so, yeah, I've definitely had some experiences in press screenings where I basically said, no, fuck that theater. I'm never going to any screenings there because the people in charge of it don't give a shit, you know? So
I should keep a running list of every movie that I almost got in a fight in this year. I think that would be an interesting end of the year category to add in. But yes, anyway, that's just my way of saying, like, this movie, 70mm, professional projection, a beautiful, beautiful piece of work.
Brad, what's that Justified line that's like, you know, if you run into assholes all day, the...
You're on your morning... or if you run into one asshole that day, you met an asshole. If you've gone through the whole day and met nothing but assholes,
you're an asshole.
I want to know the origin of that one.
All I'm doing is sitting in a theater trying to watch a movie, and half the time they're not even good movies.
Yep, that's the other big issue, is if they're not very good, then they tend to be a signal call to other people that it's not very good. So it's not about.
I think about my obituary, and if it were to say Brian Rowan stabbed in an altercation during Tree of Life, I would say, you know what? Fine, because that way everyone who read that know that I paid money to see Tree of Life. But if it were to say a young man was beaten to death after a screening of Kong Skull Island, then I just sound like some trashy asshole who got in a fight after seeing Kong Skull Island.
That movie will make me angry.
Yeah. As long as it was displayed right, right?
Oh God.
Yeah, exactly. As long as it got the aspect ratio right. Anyway, let's get back to Phantom Thread.
Some good inside baseball there.
I feel like half the reason people come to this show is just to hear about times that I've nearly died. What was the other one? Oh right, it was Detroit. That's the one where the guy like threatened to beat the shit out of
That's
me.
That's thematic though. It's okay.
Yeah, I was about to say, all right, this is a good metatextual commentary on the film. Phantom Thread. I want to congratulate all of us for not having laughed any of the times we've said woodcock.
Well, you blew it there. Jesus.
I know. I'm sorry.
This is the second Mr. Woodcock.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was Billy Bob Thornton, right? It was the...
This is a prequel taking place in the Woodcock cinematic universe.
I would almost guarantee PTA has seen Mr. Woodcock.
Yes. 100%. Once he confirmed the window wall scene, the master was like influenced by Lil Jon, all bets are off. Everything's on the table.
He's
Everyone thinks he's this severe stoic filmmaking genius, but really he's like covertly just remaking movies and pop songs all the time, to the point that he actually put Adam Sandler in one of his movies and he's like, wow, people still thought that was a prestige thing. All right,
that dude is very upfront about loving Adam Sandler movies.
Yeah,
wasn't it was Terrence Malick who said that he loved Zoolander?
Yeah. Yep,
sounds about right.
Yeah, my favorite one of those is Stanley Kubrick apparently loved White Men Can't Jump. I can't find the source for this, so I might be wrong, but he definitely thought that, like, Wesley Snipes, not definitely, but I read somewhere that he thought Wesley Snipes would be like the new Sidney Poitier. He was like, this guy is going places.
This makes me wish that Kubrick had directed Passenger 57.
To be fair, fair, Snipes did go places. Just he did not.
And he's also
to jail, right? To jail.
Yeah, I'm about to say.
He has one of my favorite lines ever, which is that thing, some motherfuckers always trying to be ice skating uphill.
Yes, it's from Blade, and some motherfuckers always want to try and ice skate uphill.
Yeah, which is funny, because I think that that's just something that he used to say all the time, and they put it into the script because it was so amazing.
Carrie Fisher kind of vibe to him. He's just like, coming up with stuff.
He's just rewriting on the fly.
Yep. Okay.
Is there anything we want to talk about in relation to... I don't want to like belabor any of these points, but you know, I find it interesting. Go ahead, Bill.
I did want to mention that I agree that I think that their future together does not involve a baby, because I cannot imagine that Woodcock would ever allow something that he couldn't tell to shut up into his life that would just look at him blankly and then continue to make more noise. I think that would absolutely fucking drive him insane.
I think he would feel a deep kinship with that baby because they're both so infantile. He'd just be like, I get it.
Is it weird? I'm imagining like Sterling Archer right now.
Wee baby Seamus.
Oh my god.
The wee baby Seamus.
Okay.
All right. Well, I think we've have we come to the end? Any final thoughts?
Well, what I was whether we had any thoughts. And I mean, I just thought what you were talking about, Brian, is interesting, but it doesn't necessarily consider Woodcock's obsession with his mother or the idea of curses. Like, I just wondered if we had any general thoughts about that or whether it's self-explanatory.
That was one of those things that was at once too abstract and too self-explanatory for me to like really invest a lot of my mental energy in. Like after viewing the film, I kind of immediately started not thinking about all that.
I definitely think it's interesting that Alma removes the never been cursed tag from the wedding dress.
I think, isn't it just never cursed?
Yeah, it says never cursed. Yeah.
Never been kissed.
The horror sequel to Never Been Kissed.
Good Drew Barrymore.
Never been cursed.
Well, I find it interesting. You know, I don't know if she actually removes it so much as she wants to see what it says. Because I don't think we ever see her like pocket it or anything like that. I think we very noticeably, obviously, see her. I think isn't at that moment that she's supposed to be sewing on the tag, and that's what she's kind of doing.
No, she like takes it off.
I think she takes it off.
Yeah, I think she takes it off as well. Well, I do want to briefly bring this up. I have gone back and forth after seeing this movie twice that, like, I think in a way that can also point to a banality. Like, I kind of think that PTA is kind of taking the piss a little bit out of Woodcock in the sense of, you know, I have heard one of the conversations about this, you know, is whether his dresses are meant to be elegant or whether they're supposed to be, you know, deliberately old fashioned. And I think even some of, like, it was interesting, we were talking about how Bill was mentioning how people on the street know him, but the line that person says at dinner is so strange. Like, she says, her friend is like, oh, she wants to be buried in one of your dresses, as if it's like a museum piece, or as if it's like something that people have deep respect for, but not necessarily like in the present. Like, I think there is like not only in undermining like the whole idea of him being a genius, but like even undermining what he is doing really has any worth, or whether it's worth the price of his ego and his lack of self-awareness. Like, I've gone back and forth on this, but I'm just wondering whether you guys had any thoughts about that generally.
I think there's the last Saturday Night Live opening monologue I watched was actually Tiffany Haddish, and she was mentioning how much her like fancy white dress was, and she was saying how she was going to wear it to all these events and like fuck all the haters about like, no, you can't wear that one dress all over the place. And she's like, no, I paid a shit ton of money for it. And so I think they mentioned that how, or I think Woodcock's actual like response to her praise initially is, I hope that I could provide that for you one day. And I think the intonation there isn't just so much like, oh, it's a museum piece. I think it's, these things are fucking expensive, and it would be her favorite piece, and so much so that when she eventually dies, she would want to be buried in it. Not so much it's a museum piece and that's like how she views it, like it's only for something as melancholy as like a funeral.
I think it's a little more ambiguous than that, though. I don't know how much I'm projecting there, but
I just thought it was funny when he pointed at that one other person and said, "You probably dig her up." Out of
yeah, that's great.
Yeah, I do think it's important to. I think that there's an air of quiet death in this house is maybe the most important line in that movie. I definitely think that there's something to be said about not only the house being somewhat haunted by not just, you know, the memory of his mother, but also the memory of past dresses, the memory of past, because, you know, it definitely feels like once they've made a dress and given it, it's like, it's almost like they're midwives, you know, they're like birthing this thing and then just sort of like, well, it's off into the world now and we got
to
move on.
Well, yeah, I mean, he seems to like not want to see it. Like I said, he doesn't want to see his dresses in the wild.
Right. But I also,
like, get it out.
I think there's something to be said about it. I don't know enough about fashion to know whether or not they're actually good looking or whatever. All I know is that I think there's something to be said about the fact that like he has a vested interest in a certain kind of aesthetic that is falling out of style. And what I think that you can read the ending in a way in which he may have let go of even slightly, just slightly let go of, you know, maintaining his legacy in favor of maintaining the relationship with Alma by way of repeated poisoning, which is the irony. Like, the irony is that the only way he can like cede his professional life to his personal life is that his personal life must also contain frequent poisoning. Like, which I don't know. I have not had a full handle on that, but I definitely think there's a lot to consider there.
Well, I mean, as a man who used to drink to the point that I couldn't get up the next morning, I understand him.
Every once in a while,
you just got to get poisoned.
What do we make of Cyril's kind of position in this film and her kind of stance? Because I think it's interesting that she very easily could have rejected Alma in a lot of ways, and yet in some way she's giving her advice. At one point she mentions to Woodcock that she actually likes her. There's and like even that sequence when Alma walks in on Woodcock just kind of rambling and tirading about Alma's effect on that house, she lets her, you know, be in that presence and lets her hear those things. I find her character really fascinating because A, she's obviously withstood Woodcock the longest, but also B, she's almost in a way helping him move forward without directly saying that.
I mean, I think that part of it is just the fact that he is such a non-communicative dick that she is the opposite. She's a straight shooter. She doesn't fucking lie to people. Mm-hmm. She doesn't sugarcoat anything. And it's in her interest for her fucking brother to get along with these women. And so she's either going to give them advice on how to work with him, or she's going to just tell him to get the hell out.
And yet her delivery is at once always so polite and so matter of fact. Like, that's the other weird part about it. Is as if it's always cloaking her true tone, but you actually listen to her words, as you're saying, she's very much a straight shooter.
Yeah.
I definitely think Cyril gains respect for Alma in two moments. The first is when she's like, no, I want to cook dinner for him. And the whole time she's like, that's not a good idea. Don't do that. Like, really don't do that. And she's like, no, fuck you. I'm going to cook dinner for him. This is ridiculous. Like, there's too many rules in this house. Like, I want to do it. And she's like, all right, good luck. And then the second time, when Alma starts calling the shots with the doctor, because Cyril's like clearly pissed that she's like, no, we got to get a doctor in here. And Alma's like, no, we don't. I'm handling it. And there's that whole funny bit where they're leading the doctor out and they're like, oh, thanks, Mrs. Woodcock. And they both respond.
Yes.
And I definitely think at that point, Cyril realizes that her, like, some of her duties have been duties, quote unquote, have been like ceded to Alma in many ways. And it became, and the only way that happened was Alma took charge. And I think that's where Cyril comes to be like, oh, I like her, because she's not a doormat. She's not someone who is just there to be almost like a model for the clothes. She's there to have an, be like an active participant in the house. Because I think before then, the only one, she's like the only person that's like the moat between like Woodcock and like the world. And she has to, like, she's the only one who will be like, stop moaning. This is ridiculous. Like some people are like gonna not wear our clothes. You gotta get over it, you know? Like, and now that Alma's there to poison him, there isn't always, like, she's not always, you know, the one in charge. And I think I definitely think that there's some sort of mutual respect that's gained from there.
I think one other moment I really want to point to, just because it's even a little more subtle than those two great moments you pointed to, Vikram, was when he's sick the first time and she's like, come join us to help. They're working on the dress where they spill something on it. And she's like, come downstairs, Alma. And she closes the door. and then goes back to like nursing Woodcock. But it's like, that might actually be the beginning of the pivot of her responding to Cyril in a different way, because that might be before the dinner, actually. I don't know.
He gets poisoned after the dinner.
All right, sorry. Okay. Either way, I think that was another scene too that shows what Vikram was talking about, but I just really loved that one, so I wanted to mention it.
This doesn't really have anything to do with anything, but I love when he meets the doctor again and he's well, but he's still treating him as though he's just as unhappy with him being there as when he was in the room,
right,
to the point where, like, apropos of nothing, he's like, didn't I tell you to fuck off?
Yes.
And it's like, why, yes, you did tell me that when you were sick, but his, like, voice is saying, like, immediately, right now, didn't I tell you that?
Sure.
Yeah.
Why are you still around me? That was an ongoing invitation to fuck off.
My favorite line in that whole movie is when he comes home for dinner and he looks at Alma on the stairs and goes, what is this? And Alma goes, I love you, Reynolds. And there's just this pause and he goes, yes, but what is this?
He's such an asshole. All right. Well, my daughter has woken up. Nope. Yeah. She's back down. Anyway, we should probably wrap up. We've been talking for almost 2 hours, and we don't want this to be one of those podcasts that goes longer than the film. Does anyone have any, like, final declarative sentence that they would like to say about this
movie? I don't want this to be Daniel Day-Lewis's best or last performance. I think this is a different version of him that we got in a while, and I would like to see this version.
Seconded.
Yeah, you can definitely see, like, I'm kind of hot and cold on Daniel Day-Lewis generally. I think when he's great, he's great. But I think here, when he's speaking in his own accent, he's like not straining to like capital A act. And I love that.
I just want a GIF that is nothing but him brushing his hair. All right. Well, that's all for today. That was our review of Phantom Thread, which is out in theaters now. Check it out.
Brian, do you ultimately recommend this after this conversation?
You know, I have literally no idea. It would really depend on the person.
Okay.
You know, I have my friends who, like, when they ask me what's good out, I don't bother to tell them if, like, there's an indie film that I think they'd like.
Sure.
I think that there are people who I would tell to go see this just because I'd be interested in their thoughts. And, there are people, I don't know if I could conceive of someone really loving this film, but there's people I know who could probably, like, get something interesting out of it. So I won't tell anyone not to see it. If you're interested in it, you know, for God's sakes, go and give money to Paul Thomas Anderson. Like,
I'm recommending.
Yeah, I think there's things worth viewing in this movie. And I look forward to seeing it again. And if I don't like it, I'm going to expect Vikram to give me $20. So that's it. That's all for today. Just a reminder, if you enjoy listening to us, you can help us out by going to patreon.com/thefilmstageshow and giving us as little as $1 per episode. You get access to our Slack channel, raffles, and of course, you become part of the future of this podcast. We will be reviewing Paris, Texas at some point this month. We should probably start trying to figure out when, but we'll continue to procrastinate on that for now.
And there's course, a lot of conversations on Slack these days, so if you want to be part of bizarre conversations from Twin Peaks to
Justice for Ellie.
Oh my god.
Look, the fact that Funko Pop hasn't put out an Ellie Sattler thing is fucking bananas.
Guys, this
is coming
yesterday.
In the next wave. It's coming in the next
fucking
wave.
Fucking better. It goddamn better. Anyway, also you can go to Mubi.
There's no Muldoon either.
Oh well, that's even crazier. You know what?
Yes.
You know, boycott Funko.
Yeah, fuck Funko.
You can go to MUBI.com. I am trying to do the movie plug, Bill. My child is waking up and I need to go see to her. MUBI.com/filmstage for your free 30-day trial of MUBI, the coolest, best cultivated streaming platform out there. MUBI.com/filmstage. They've got a bunch of great stuff and better is coming out. And again, if you are in New York or LA, or if you just want to see if it's coming to you, go check them out to find out when Lover for a Day by Philippe Garrel is hitting a theater by you. One more time. That is MUBI.com/filmstage. And yeah, that's it. So now we can tell the fine people where we can be found at home, and then we can get out of here. So, Vikram, you're our special guest. Why don't you kick us off and tell the people at home where you can be found now that they know you and they love you?
I hope they love me. I can just say the best way to find me is through Twitter, which is at FauxBeatPoet. That's my handle, FauxBeatPoet. I usually put all my recent writing there. You can find me once again at the AV Club. I regularly write for the AV Club, Vulture and RogerEbert.com. And yeah.
You're doing High Maintenance, aren't you?
I am. I'm covering High Maintenance this season. That's good.
Woo!
I'm excited about that.
My dog is excited about that.
Oh.
Bill Graham, what about you?
You can find me on Twitter at CableBFG. You can also find me on the Slack channel. Yeah, just stirring up shit.
All right, Michael Snydell.
You can find me on Twitter at Snydell, Letterboxd, same thing. And yeah, I'm also on the Slack channel bugging people.
All right. And of course, you can find me on Twitter at Brian J. Rowan. Same for Letterboxd and pretty much all of this social media. My writing is at thefilmstage.com, as well as my personal site, dearfilm.net. And yeah, that's all. I've got to go take care of my daughter because she is stirring and very soon will be up and screaming. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. And tune in next week when we're talking about... Guys, what are we talking about next week?
Paddington 2.
All
right. Itanya, maybe?
Maybe Itanya. At some point, we're doing our top 10 list.
I don't know.
Follow us on Twitter at Film Stage Show, and we'll probably tell you when we figure it out. Until then, until next time, have a great day. For this dread-